And welcome into the No Noise Podcast once again. This is James Fletcher.
Hello, everybody. It's your favorite person, Trevin Pierna-Will,
I
because
don't know about
I'm the favorite person on the podcast.
that.
I get recognized the most when I go
Do
out.
you?
I do. People walk up to me and it's like, aren't you the guy from the, and I'm like, yeah, that's me.
Man, people see me sometimes. They'll be talking to me.
That's a lie.
No,
that's a lie.
No, for real. I do.
Okay.
You know, and I'm making those radio appearances. You guys got to check me out when I'm on Tide 102.9. Always getting in there trying to do some producing work, and then I also get to talk on the air sometimes. This morning I was hosting the Blitz Martin Houston show on that station. Great show from 6 to 7 a.m., so a lot of people are not awake for it. I'm only half awake for it, if I'm being honest, sometimes, but it's a great time, and got to talk some Alabama basketball this morning, talk to some callers about, you know, the state of the program, what's going on, and
yeah, how do
what
most
we need
people
to do
feel right now? Let me ask you that.
Let me tell you, the student section feels one way, and then the alumni slash fans outside, I feel like, feel a completely different way.
I've gotten that tone too, where the students are like, "We're okay," and then the alumni is like, mm-hmm. "Let's get rid of him."
Right. That's what it is. The students, I think, have seen Avery Johnson has put a lot of effort into engaging the students. And I think it's paid off, and the students now really do appreciate what's the improvement that they've seen in the program. And so I think the students maybe aren't okay with this, how the season went. They expected a little bit better, but I don't think that they're calling for radical changes to what's going on. Just a couple of tweaks here and there. On the other hand, the alumni fan base, you know, outside of campus, they're ready for a change. They are ready to move on. They don't think that, I mean, they haven't seen the benefits that the students have seen. I don't think they haven't gotten that same level of engagement that the campus has gotten. And so I understand the different viewpoints. It's an awkward situation to be in, though, because of course we're all interacting through social media, and it's caused over the last couple of days a little bit of friction between the two groups. Some calling for a bunch of changes, and some saying, well, if you think that it needs all this change, maybe you're part of the problem. And it's awkward, I'm not gonna lie. And it all goes back, and we got a couple of wins, but then you got two of the toughest games of your season. LSU, highly ranked top 15 team. They got a lot of big men. They can shoot the ball really well. So it's a tough matchup for us. And then you got Auburn here. And yes, they're two home games, so you really needed to win one of them. But I think it was the way that we lost them that was the hardest.
Yeah, watching those games, you were invested every single point. And there was a point, I think we were up in every game, at least by, I want to say, 5 points. In every game. And so you think like, oh shoot, we got this in the bag. Especially like, I know for Auburn, it was definitely in the first half where I was just like, oh, okay, we're up by a good bunch here.
Right, even when they would make a run, we would counter and get it back up to 10.
Right. And I would be like, all right, we still got momentum on our side. We're good. I'm not really worried about it. LSU was kind of a different story. It was very back and forth just the whole time. So I was a little more concerned about that. But like there was a point, like I said, there was a point where we were up by 5 points in every game, and you're sitting there just like, all right, we have the potential to actually pull this off. And then it would come on the back end where the team, like Auburn or LSU, would respond with a nice run, tie it up, and you're sitting there with 3 minutes left, and you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
And then they still tit for tat going back and forth, just like, all right, you get a basket, we get a basket, you get a basket, we get a basket. And it's like just this back and forth kind of game. You're just like, all right, all we have to do is just make the last basket. All we have to do is respond last, and we can win this game. And then an unfortunate turnover,
yeah,
kills all hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're just like, all right, that's the L. I was happy with the two games. I'm going to be honest with you. Auburn, not so much, but LSU, I was happy with the result. Because they at least fought the whole time. And to me, that one wasn't a tale of two halves because they played extremely well in both halves. It was just an unfortunate mistake on senior day by Riley Norris who had a turnover at an inopportune time. That happens, okay? Yep. You're against the now ranked number 10 team in the nation, I assume. I think they moved up in the rankings after that game. You're going against the number 10 ranked team in the nation. You made a turnover. It gave them a 4-point lead. You had to come – like, it happens sometimes, okay? So it was a good game for me. They fought hard. I liked it. Auburn was just – oh, that crushed my heart.
It was a tough one to take. The way it ended with the turnover I thought was rough. You got Kyra Lewis, who's been by far the most consistent player on this team all season. We talked about this last time we spoke about just Kyra Lewis being that stabilizing force at any given moment in a game. And I think that it is a knock on him, I think, but not something that he can't overcome. That the moment got big, and I think he realized it, but he wasn't necessarily fully up to it. And I think that, you know, you look at the LSU game, his worst game of the season to that point, by, I'd say, a pretty wide margin in terms of his impact on the game. He struggled a lot. He played 38 minutes, but with 7 points, only 3 of 16 shooting. I think he got baited into a lot of shots. He was pulling up from 19, 20 feet away, way more than is, you know, considered efficient. And a lot of those were even contested, passed on a couple of 3-pointers because it was clear from the start that he wasn't feeling his shot from deep. Ended up 0 for 4. But I thought then he turned around and I gave him the benefit of the doubt, and I said, I expect him to come back at Auburn and play one of the best games of the season. And he played well for a large portion of the game, but like the entire team, he was not able to finish strong. And the turnover at the end, of course, was devastating. And I thought it really signified to me that this team, although the bracketologists all say they still have a shot, they still can get in, they're still even expected at this point, you would say, based off of where they are in all the brackets, to get into the tournament, it didn't feel like the players felt that way. You see, when Kyra Lewis turned that ball over, there was a look of panic on Kyra's face that I expect from a player who just made a turnover in the final seconds of a game that they were trying to come back in. But what really signified to me how the team felt was Dante Hall and his reaction as he inbounds the ball to Kyra and begins to jog up the floor. He sees the ball go to the Auburn player and turns around away from the Auburn player with his hands in the air. It was, and there's still time on the clock, a 4-point game, and so you still have to foul there. Dante Hall was the closest player to the ball at that point. He should have been sprinting to foul him. But it felt like this moment of realization for him, at least, where he said, it's over. This is it. And it's sad that it came at that point against that team and all of that. It's terrible. But I don't like our chances to get into the tournament. And I've heard from a couple of sources that the team, if asked to take a vote on it, would not be expected to convince, at least it'd be a very close vote if it went through to accept a bid to the NIT. And so we'll see how that develops, if the coaching staff ends up making the decision or if the players end up, you know, maybe they, of course there's time left, maybe they can talk more guys into agreeing to do it, maybe they do decide not to go. But whatever the result is, we're nearing the end of the season for the Alabama Crimson Tide.
So, looking at bracketology right now here on ESPN, we are now the last four in. Mm-hmm.
It's on a weak bubble.
Yeah, so right now we're on a 12 seed scheduled to face Temple to play into the tournament. And then we have the opponent that we beat last year in Virginia Tech as our first team in San Jose, California, that we would face. Honestly, I kind of like the odds of that. I'm going to be completely honest with you. I like the Midwest part of the bracket. Virginia Tech, we beat them last year. I feel like we can beat them again. They're only a 5 seed, so that's kind of actually kind of helpful in our favor a little bit, I would
say.
That's
a team that they don't terrify you.
Yeah, they
to
don't
see
terrify
on
you
on the bracket.
And then when you come out of that, you're either facing Wisconsin or Vermont, another team that doesn't terrify me
right. So
much, as opposed to seeing a 3 seed like a Texas Tech, even though they're in a weaker conference, in my opinion, or a North Carolina. So if you can get a couple of wins here in the SEC tournament, which is what it's going to take. At this point, is 2 or 3 wins in the SEC tournament, which the team is very capable of. They need to understand that the season's not over. Okay,
right.
Like, you still have 2 tournaments left available for you to finish out this season. There have been teams before, like Jim Valvano's North Carolina State, where they weren't even picked to win their conference, and yet somehow they managed to go on a nice run there. All it takes is a good collection of games, and you can make a great run here in the
tournament.
Right,
and with the weak bubble this season, it's easier than ever to make it into the NCAA tournament, it seems.
Exactly.
I think it starts, though, you have to get a win against Arkansas. I think
there's no doubt.
There's no doubt you have to win.
You have to win Arkansas if you want even a small, slight chance to possibly even get into the tournament.
Right, and that's what scares me, is that this Arkansas team, we're playing them in their arena. We're playing them off of an 84-48 win on the road.
To who?
At Vanderbilt.
Oh, gosh.
And of course, Vanderbilt has not won a game in the SEC yet.
Vanderbilt is trash, but even
still. But
to
win 84-48 on its own is just absurd. And then to do it in that arena, which, you know, everyone is horrified of playing there, it scares me, because they're the exact type of team that we struggle with, too. Where they have one dominant big man in Daniel Gafford, who can really just go head-to-head with Dante Hall. And then they've got a lot of three-point shooters on the wing. It's a lot of young guards who are going to take shots from the outside. And that's what teams that have had success against us have done, in large part, when they've beaten us.
Yeah, so looking at their schedule, the 2 of their wins are against Vandy. They've beaten LSU at LSU. That's impressive. They've beaten Georgia. And they've beaten Ole Miss. They've won against very quality teams. They've had a very, very tough schedule, in my opinion, on the road against bad teams. And so that's kind of hard to, when you're on the road, to pull out victories. I'm not saying it's going to be good for us. Then you have good teams at home, like Mississippi State. I'm going to say Texas A&M, even though I still think they're a bad team. But, you know, they beat us twice, so what can I say, you know? And also playing at Kentucky, and you only lose by 4 at Kentucky when they're ranked number 4 in the nation at the time. This team is kind of getting it together, kind of trending upwards. So, yeah, man, this is. I thought the stretch earlier where we had to go 3-3 was tough, but man, the way this ended
now coming down to one game.
Yeah, coming down the back stretch with Auburn, LSU, and now Arkansas trending upwards. It's not looking pretty in the SEC.
No, it's
toughest
not,
conference right now.
And this is an Arkansas team that, as you know, at the beginning of the season, I had high hopes for what they could become, and they didn't develop that. And I think a lot of that was they're a young team. Their best shooters, their best scorers are all young guys. And Daniel Gafford really tried his best to carry this team, and it wasn't enough. And so they're a team that still – it's not like a Vanderbilt where against Vanderbilt you were scared to play in their arena because of the history, but you weren't scared of that roster. You weren't scared of the players that were there. Same with a Georgia. You know, Claxton's a good player, but – He's not on his own going to beat you just if you play well as a team. So, but Arkansas has the pieces to do that. It's just a matter of whether or not they're clicking throughout the game. And this Arkansas team, you look at in the middle of their conference schedule, their toughest run, you know, they lost, let's see, 6 games in a row. You turn that into a, you know, 2-4. I think they're on this bubble as well that so many teams seem to be on right now. If they can get to 18-12 rather than 16-4 with, you know, that Kentucky game, if I'm being honest, I think they should have won. Kentucky got bailed out more than once in that game with the violation on the inbounds. The ball went off of their players multiple times, and it was still given to Kentucky. It just, you know, so many things went against them, and they still only lose by four at the very end. I thought that was really where they kind of turned the corner, and it was unfortunate that it happened with just three games remaining after that. But it's still scary to be an Alabama team heading to their place while they're riding so high at this time.
Yeah, also looking at just the SEC overall, the West was loaded this year. LSU, Auburn, South Carolina, or LSU, Auburn, Mississippi State, Ole Miss, and Florida. And I think Arkansas is in the West, too.
Well, Florida's in the East.
Florida, excuse me. Yeah. Ole Miss, Arkansas.
About as east as you can get.
Yeah. So Arkansas, Texas A&M are the only Western teams below us. Missouri, Georgia, and Vandy from the East are carrying out the bottom three. So, you know, but the East also had Tennessee and Kentucky, so two very top teams. And then the rest of the conference is all bottom.
It's the best year this conference has had in a long time.
It's been a tough year. So, like I said, if we could get at least 500 in SEC play, I feel like we're still looking pretty good. So we can beat Arkansas here and then go into tournament, get two more wins just to put us a little bit above 500 in conference play. We can easily pull this out. It's very frightening, and I think Avery Johnson, with his job on the line, has to do it.
Right. I think what it's going to take is a win against Arkansas and one win in the tournament. I don't think you have to get two, because you're probably going to be playing in Auburn, someone of that caliber who's solidly in the field in that second round.
But then you already have momentum from the first round.
Oh, right. Of course, we want the win. We want as many as we can get.
Yeah,
I'm just talking what's needed to get into the tournament, I would say. A lot like last year with the Colin Sexton team that was considered on the bubble, went in, won the game they needed to win, and then continued to advance through the next game and ended up a nine seed, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, if you get hot at the right time, then you can – with how weak this back end is, you can definitely get up and be even a 10 seed, I think, at best. But the scariest scenario for me here is that you get a couple of upsets in the right conferences. You look at the SoCon. Wofford is an NCAA tournament team, regardless of whether they win their tournament or not. So does Wofford kind of take their foot off the gas at all in their conference tournament? Do they slip up and, you know, allow a Furman or a UNC Greensboro to take home that conference championship, and then that bumps everyone down one spot when it comes to that bubble? That's what's scary to me. You also look at the Ohio Valley, Murray State, very good team. I still think that regardless of – I think Belmont and Murray State will likely get into the tournament. And that means only one of them can win. So that bumps another team down. And we're talking about now two less spots. You're talking about really just two more open spots in that last four that you're going to let in that are there at this moment. And so can Alabama assert themselves as one of the teams that deserves that spot when you look at the rest of the teams there? Seton Hall got a huge win in their last game. You look at Clemson. Clemson, a team that, they've got a pretty good resume despite their record. They've played a lot of close games with a lot of good teams, and they've got some good wins as well. And Temple, I do think that we have a better resume than Temple. We have more losses, but we've played a lot more quality opponents than they have. And so I look at this and I say it's going to be tight. We're going to be waiting on Selection Sunday to hear whether our name is called or not when it comes down to it.
Yeah, most definitely. I agree with everything basically that you said, and I don't say that very often. Right? So
I do provide great insight. So
every once in a while you say something that's somewhat accurate, so I'll let you slide on this one. Like I said, just looking at the tournament, you got to pull out at least two, in my opinion, in the tournament. Like I said, the 12 spot, I like that positioning. Honestly, if the tournament were to go down today, I do like our odds again to still make it.
Right, with because the teams you listed that we would have to play
are beatable.
I think we won't be going into those games like we did in the Villanova game last season.
Where we just sat there and we were just like, oh, we're about to get our butts kicked.
Right. You know, you just knew the talent and the experience like on that team was going to be too much.
Like, you just sat there and you watched and you were sitting there like before the game. It's like, maybe we could pull this off. Maybe there's a slimmer.
And then the first
hole.
10 minutes you're saying, oh, man, we're sticking around.
And then
a, what, 20-0 run or something just ridiculous like that by Jalen Brunson.
Yeah, so like those three, like I like the positioning. If we were to stay here and like nothing changed until the tournament and we got that 12th spot and we just had to play in, I kind of like those odds. I think Avery Johnson performs well sometimes with his back against the wall.
Yeah.
So it really is a coin flip on what kind of day he's going to have coaching. Like against Oklahoma last year, his back was against the wall. People were wondering if, you know, could he actually beat a team with like a top 10 recruit for real. And he came out and he performed, you know. His back was against the wall last year when they played Texas A&M in the tournament. It's like, can they actually pull it off and get to the tournament? Last second play, which he's now used for Kyra Lewis, I think, three times now. You need to come up with something different. That's basically what I'm telling you. But anyways, that nice dribble down court, half court floater that they did. They pulled it off. Nice clutch shooting by everyone involved. And then even still, you said, you know, let's double down. Let's beat Auburn, too, because why not? Let's beat them two times in 1 year.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do like our odds if we play Auburn again. I'm going to be completely honest with you. First time was a blowout. It was at their place.
I think it depends on how we come out. If we come out the way we left the court last game,
I feel like that's motivation.
No,
I feel like that's motivation.
Right. But because it all depends on where their head's at in that locker room.
I agree.
You know, you can use it for motivation or you can get down.
But like I say, in football, it's hard to beat somebody twice in the same season.
Right.
In basketball, it's not necessarily hard to beat somebody twice. It's hard to beat somebody three times.
Yeah.
Someone's going to catch you at least once, you know. And I like the odds because we keep getting closer and closer and closer.
Yeah.
So like the first time was at their place, we all knew it was not going to be pretty.
Oh, no.
This time around, they had the chance to win. They made a mistake. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
How they build on that and move it forward? Because I think they'll come out energized against Arkansas. I really hope so.
I really hope so.
And I really think that they will come out energized against Arkansas. I think they're going to crush it and win by at least 10. And then we're going into the SEC tournament. They're going to play that first game. It's not going to be Auburn. I think it'll be maybe a Georgia or an Ole Miss, who knows?
Yeah,
bracket hasn't come out yet. A team that you've beaten before and handedly, so you can just do it again, you know, and move forward. You get Auburn probably. That'll probably be your next opponent. It'll be an Auburn or a Florida, I should say, maybe.
Somewhere, just like
a good mid-tier team.
One of the teams that's in the tournament, but that, you know, not a top 25 team.
Yeah, so you're going to face one of those guys, and you know you can beat them if you bring your best.
Yeah.
Just pull that off, and then you're going to get a Kentucky or a Tennessee.
Right.
And then who knows what happens on that day, because you can beat both of them.
Tennessee,
we showed
we can play with them. We showed we can beat Kentucky.
Exactly. You showed you can beat them.
Right.
So who knows what's going to happen. Like I said, once you get through the regular season, just like LeBron James, the playoffs are a different story. Everybody's set back at 0-0, okay? Just go out there and just play ball. Everything in the regular season doesn't matter. That was for chemistry's sake, okay? Once the ball is tipped and it's tournament time, it's about that one game, that one opportunity, and anybody can get beat on any given day. That's all I got to say about it.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to give you guys a little bit of insight. We're going to go in here, talk a little NBA mock draft, since mine will be posting as soon as the end of the regular season. Hopefully is when it'll drop. But I've got my board here, got some risers, got some people who fell down the board. I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, who I've got that has impressed me the most since January 1st, when my mock draft 2.0, which you can find on WVUA's Game Day website, you can look that up, see where I had people on January 1st, see where they're going to be now as we end the regular season. I'll then post another one after March Madness, and then, of course, through the off season, continue to update it.
Right.
I want to tell you the biggest riser in my mock draft at this point.
Ja Morant.
No, he's not actually, because I already had him at number 7.
Right now he's
in my last mock draft. I was high on him. I'm not going to act like I discovered him or anything, but yeah, I was high on him before a lot of mock drafters were. I thought once Garland went down, I thought Morant had every opportunity to become a top 10 pick because there weren't many other point guards who were going to be used as often as he was in the offense, you know, to really surpass him. And I think that's proven correct. And of course, his freak athleticism has helped that. And a lot of people have noticed. I have him at 2 now, actually. All the way up to 2. That's because the Suns are currently selecting there. I think he'll drop if the Suns end up with the number 1 pick. But the Suns need a point guard. So why not go get a Russell Westbrook-like player to take over that position? The biggest riser on my board is Coby White from North Carolina, a guy who in the first half of the season, he was putting up some decent numbers, but no one really took much notice. I didn't even have him in the first round of my January 1st mock draft. Now I have him at number 7, going to the Hawks via the Mavericks pick. Right now, Coby White is an incredible scorer. If you haven't seen him, you should go check out his highlight reel. At North Carolina, he has really taken over the bulk of the scoring. When he's feeling it from deep, he can walk into a three from anywhere on the court, and it doesn't matter how close to him you are. The knock on him is his height. He's a short guy. And
he's 6'5".
Coby White?
Yeah, from North Carolina?
With the afro, maybe?
Okay, it must be 6'5 with the hair.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
It must be 6'5 with the
hair. He does not look right now, like he's 6'5".
Right now, according to NBADraft.net and also ESPN, they have him listed at 6'5".
I have seen things that said he's smaller than that, but if he really is, and if he really is 6'5", that's incredible. Because when I saw him next to R.J. Barrett, they were not the same height. But
RJ's
6'7". You never know. RJ's listed at 6'7" on
RJ's
there.
RJ's listed at 6'7". Coby White's listed at 6'5".
Well, that website is using different heights than what I've seen.
ESPN,
yeah. I mean, of course, when they're in college, it's usually a lot of estimates, a lot of former measurements, and then sometimes they project. ESPN usually has pretty accurate ones, though. So if that's true, then yeah, that was the knock on him coming into North Carolina, I know, was that he was a small guy and that he was thin, and they didn't know how his body would hold up, you know, going against bigger players. But
he does have dog in him. He does have dog in him.
He does. He's got that scrappy little guy feel to him where he's not going to get bullied. You got a little bit of that, you know, that fire in him. And it doesn't matter how close you get to him, when he's feeling it, he will pull, and usually he's going to make that shot. A couple of other big risers. Jarrett Culver, a big riser on my board, up 20 spots from the last mock draft. That one, I saw the talent in Jarrett Culver, but the positional need and the number of guys who I had at that position who were above him at that time kind of facilitated where I had him. And so he has impressed since then, a guy at Texas Tech who has, you know, really led that team this season. Not highly recruited, but he's really impressed in his time there. He's a sophomore now in his second year. He'll probably be a top 10 pick, I think, given the needs of the different teams that are selecting. He's a shooting guard with some size.
Honestly, I'm really worried about shooting guards heading into this draft. Because
that's why he went up 20 spots.
Yeah,
I'm really concerned about a lot of these guys.
Number one, because the shooting guard position has kind of died a little bit with the
all about the wing.
With the point, not only with the wing, but with the point guard renaissance that's come down. Point guards. And so your wing player, your 3 and your 4 have been able to score more in the NBA and has had the ball in their hands more. And then your 1 is having the ball in their hands more, looking to score, not necessarily pass. So the 2 guy has kind of just been a 3-and-D kind of guy for the most part, looking at the best guy that everybody says in the league, Klay Thompson.
Yeah.
So he's the perfect 3-and-D kind of guy. So And with Dwayne Wade retiring this year, kind of the
with
old
the Bradley. There's not many Bradley Beals left.
Yeah, there's not many. You know, there's Bradley.
And even Beal benefits from Wall being out because he's now the primary ball handler within the offense. Not necessarily bringing it up the court, but in terms of getting the shots.
So right now, I only count two elite like shooting guards, kind of in my opinion, and that is Bradley Beal and Devin Booker. Outside of that,
James Harden is technically
a
shooting guard.
I don't
but
count James Harden.
Right. He's playing point
he's
guard.
He's playing point guard. Chris Paul has more so been a two guard that guards the one on defense. Yeah. That's basically what he is at this point. Yeah, those two are basically point guards. You know,
they're just playing two point guards.
Yeah, they're just playing two point guards. But outside of James Harden, you know, it's really just come down to Bradley Beal and Devin Booker kind of holding the mantle for that position and Klay Thompson. But you know, there's out of four elite shooting guards, I feel like teams are going to overcommit to getting a good one of those, especially if they can see there's a good 3-and-D kind of guy.
That's what happens a lot.
Because when you see – because honestly, this year it's going to be the shooting guard. Next year it's probably going to be the power forward or the center.
Yes, next year is going to be a center power forward heavy draft with Wiseman and Vernon Carey and just a lot of big men who have a lot of versatile skills.
Yes. So it's when you see the old guard kind of dying off, someone has to replace that. So I feel like teams are right. That's the main reason why I'm saying that. With Dwayne Wade leaving, Kobe Bryant retiring a couple of years ago, who else was a good one? You know, there's been a couple of good shooting guards recently. Ray Allen's gone, you know.
Ray Allen, yeah.
You're top-tier kind of guys. Even Jason Terry I kind of put in that conversation because he was a very good helper on that end of the floor.
Yeah.
They're going to overcommit trying to get that next guy at the shooting guard position. Like this year they're trying to get – or like the past couple of years has all been about who's going to get the next center. So it was Carl Anthony Towns, DeAndre Ayton, Anthony Davis, who they picked correctly on.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's always been overcommit of who's going to be the next center because everybody thinks you have to have a center and a small in order to win in this game, which the Warriors proved you don't technically have to have that. But, you know, there's overcommit to the big guy at this point. So I'm not going to be surprised if there's going to be a small shift in the next couple of years moving to the shooting guard position because there's such a small window here where someone can really rise up like Donovan Mitchell, who's on the rise coming up.
And that's kind of the rotation of the NBA, the way it works. You look at you get a few years of a dominant position, and then as they rotate through and they start to retire off, you often see a new group of a lot of guys at that position. And I think the reason that you see that is that when this group, so we'll take the center group for example, the Anthony Davises, the Joel Embiids, all of that. The kids who are watching now, a lot of them are going to be imitating that position.
Yes.
And imitating that. So those bigger kids who grow up and they're taller, they're going to be more likely to say, hey, let me imitate my game after this. Let me work to get better.
Looking at the Ben Simmons, the
Giannis's. Same way that everyone looked at Kobe and Iverson and Ray Allen and said, I want to do that. And now we're seeing a lot of shooting guards come through. Yeah. You see a rotation of the kid, the position that's idolized. So I look at, you know, you had your Shaq era. And then Shaq is now moved on, and the people who were kids when he was big, and the centers were dominant. Your Tim Duncans, your all of those. Now we're seeing a new batch of centers who were kids during that era.
I like how, and I know we're going on NBA tangent here, but I like to see how the positions have kind of evolved over what's the best position. Like that kids love to emulate because it started with Magic when they saved the league. Magic, everybody wanted to be the point guard. Give me the ball and let me pass it around. I love passing the ball.
Except for the white kids, they wanted to be the Larry Bird.
Not everybody can be 6'10 and a trash talker and call shots and shoot with both of your hands whenever you wanted to. Right. And let's not forget Larry Bird had Kevin McHale. Anyways,
he did.
But Magic Johnson, everybody wanted to be Magic, and even little white kids wanted to be Magic. Like, pass the ball wherever I want to, and just make people look good. Like,
yeah,
that's what I want to do. And then it evolved into the Michael Jordan era, where everybody was like, "Oh, I want to be the shooting guard. Yeah. I want to be the second big guy. I just want, hey, give me the ball down here. Let me go to work. Let me show
off. They realize shooting guard doesn't have to help everyone else. He can just do what's best for him.
He can just do what's best for him. You know, let me just ball out here. Yeah, flourish. Yeah. And then it moved on to the Shaq era. You know, not every kid could be Shaq, but they wish they could be. Like, everybody can't be Shaq, but everybody wish they could be just physically dominant.
I mean, everyone wanted to break a backboard.
Everybody wanted to break a backboard. He was really the generation that was just like, let me try and dunk it as hard as possible. Yeah. Can. Michael made it look good, but Shaq was the one that made people put some power behind it. So everybody was going like, let me see if I can break this backboard, be physically intimidating. Let's get big. Let's get strong. And then after that, it moved back because everybody saw Kobe and they saw Allen Iverson. And they was like, oh, wait, no. You know, being big is nice, but not everybody can be big. Everybody can at least grab the ball and
everyone can jack up threes.
Do a post move and just shoot. And then now it's moved to LeBron James, to where everybody was like, all right, you know, I may not be the biggest guy on the court, but I'm not going to be the smallest guy on the court. See, you know, now, when I play, so I can do a bit of everything. Let me rebound.
That's a thing, but I also think we're in this weird era where it's not many people can identify with the two biggest and best players, because I think Giannis is quickly catching up to LeBron as he winds down in his prime is ending or over. But you look at Giannis as he comes up, how many of us can relate to Giannis and the height, the wingspan, the physical skills? I mean, you know, we look at it, and of course we all want to be that, and we all want to do the things he does, but we just, like, 99.9% of the population just can't even imitate it.
Yeah, so like I said, like LeBron, I'm thinking about the Miami Heat LeBron.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's
what
I'm saying here. Like, that LeBron, everybody wants to be that
guy.
But
I'm saying the shift now that we're in. We're in this new era.
It goes from it shifts from small to big, and now we're going back small with Stephen Curry, because now everybody's shooting threes now. That's the big hot thing, is everybody wants to shoot threes. And, you know, I think the next guy who everybody's going to want to be like, he's in this draft. It's Zion Williamson. Zion, is going to be the next guy everybody's like, oh, you know, Shaq did it, but Zion's way more athletic than
Shaq.
So
do you think that – let me get this straight here, because we talked about Giannis. Now we talked about the people who will be imitated. Do you think that Giannis is so uniquely skilled and gifted that he won't be imitated the same way that others have in the past?
Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. Because you look at
which starts an interesting conversation in the greatest of all time, which, not to say that Giannis is there yet, but if we say hypothetically he continues on the path he's down, he's definitely going to at least get some mentions. And so
I need to see him win a playoff game.
Well, of course. No, we're talking like down the line here. We're talking when he's 34.
He can end up being Charles Barkley very quickly.
Right. But we're talking like he becomes LeBron now, like 34 years old. And we see all of his accomplishments. We can see where he ranks on the all-time list. We can see how many categories he's passed Jordan in, all that stuff.
Okay.
Will it benefit him that we look back and say he was so gifted that people couldn't imitate it? Or will it be a knock that, hey, people don't imitate you? You're not on the same level as LeBron and MJ.
So,
which one will it be?
So to me, it's an enhancement instead of a hindrance. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the NBA over years, I know we're going to the NBA right now.
All
right. Shaquille O'Neal is going to be my main example. Okay. Shaquille O'Neal was extremely talented, and he was just a physical dominating person. You just couldn't duplicate that probably ever again. Okay,
like, right.
The man was, I want to say, about 320, playing center. I think 7 feet tall, and he ran like a gazelle in his prime. People forget that. Shaquille O'Neal was
because he stayed in the league so long.
He was running up and down the court almost as fast as the next guard.
Yeah.
And he was just coming down, and there was just a train literally running at everybody. Like, He like the only reason why Shaquille O'Neal doesn't have more points in the league is because people used to elbow him when he was a rookie. Okay, that's the legit the only reason for half of his career, people could elbow him in the face when he came in the lane. Okay, if people couldn't like if he was under the rules now, oh my gosh, you're talking Kareem numbers, you're talking Karl Malone type numbers for his career because he would just physically dominate anybody that came against him and he slowed the game down. So the Warriors run and gun type of thing that they do, not only would Shaquille O'Neal block their shot on the end of the basket, he would also just control the paint. Like, you're just not going to do anything for like a good 5 seconds here. Let's all chill out, take a water break. You know, let's relax here. Okay, but looking in the into the future history, I feel like Steph Curry is going to get more recognition than Giannis Antetokounmpo because Steph Curry has rings. I don't know about Giannis at this point. If he stays in Milwaukee, I doubt that he wins a ring just because of how powerful teams like Boston and the 76ers and the Knicks are as organizations. I mean, big market, it's hard to win in small market teams. Ask Reggie Miller, ask Charles Barkley, you know, it's ask Tim Duncan. He's done it 5 times, and it was probably extremely hard. Right, but he had to do it with the same cast of people.
I look at Giannis, and I think he's going to have that LeBron effect where he can bring anyone in that he wants, like but LeBron did to Cleveland.
But even still, LeBron even talked about it. He couldn't bring anybody that he wanted to.
Right, not anyone, but I think Giannis is.
He had to have the right. He had to really stretch which people he could bring in.
I think the fact that Anthony Davis. His list, which he claims was not ever a real thing, consisted of, you know, L.A., New York, and Milwaukee. I think that speaks volumes how much respect Giannis has among these players. And Budenholzer, too. You got to remember, a lot of it's the coach, too.
Because
you look
at
the Spurs and you talk about Tim Duncan, a lot of it was players wanted to go play for Popovich as well.
Yeah. I'm not going to count the Anthony Davis trade declaration as anything except as a piece of paper because
that was a Rich Paul tactic.
He put teams on there that literally couldn't get him except for the Lakers. So I really put little to no, like they literally went out of their way to pick teams that couldn't pick him except for the Lakers. So I put no surface on that whatsoever. But the only reason why I think Giannis will have that effect of he was so physically unique that he could get to the basket, and that's going to help his Hall of Fame case because they're like, this was a 6'11 guy who could handle the ball like a point guard and who could just slam it in your face whenever he wanted to because he has long arms, played defense extremely well. Him and Ben Simmons are going to get that type of recognition. Like, these are the only two guys in the league that could pull this off. But also their hindrances, when the three game was thriving, they couldn't make it.
Yeah.
You know, the outside shot is going, but that was the one thing that they really couldn't do.
Right.
So until I see Giannis make an effort to actually expand on that, which he did.
He
has been working on it, unlike Ben Simmons, who I think will die out in a couple of years if he doesn't work on that. Giannis has made an effort to try and get that three-point shot kind of going. So
and it looks good. It doesn't fall as much as
good.
He
has about 2 or 3 more years left to actually get that together before he has – until you reach that career plateau where it's just not going to happen. Yeah. I think it's year 8 or year 9 where you've been in the league long enough.
You've learned what you're going to learn.
You've learned what you're going
to
learn.
You're now trying to perfect it.
You're now trying to perfect it. That's that plateau. It's just not going to work. Mm-hmm. Okay. You're not – like LeBron, I think he started doing the three thing.
Right, and you look at MJ, too.
Right before Cleveland.
Neither of them were really good three-point shooters earlier in their career.
Yeah, but they had
they
to develop that
it.
Game.
Yes.
Same thing with Kobe. Kobe was not a good three-point shooter coming out, but he had to learn to develop that. Even Stephen Curry was – I mean, he was a good three-point shooter.
He's improved since he came in the league.
He was a good three-point shooter, but now he's elite. Like, there was a point where people would be like, all right, maybe we'll leave him open. Like, the scouting report was like, don't try and leave him open, but at the same time, you know, it's okay if he shot the ball, okay? But now it's at a point where it's just like you need a full-court press on Stephen Curry. He's developed to that point where it's just like, all right, it's ridiculous if he makes this, all right? Like, he's literally blindfolding himself, just tossing it up, and it's going in every single time. So that's kind of what I'm saying is I think Zion Williamson is going to be that next guy. He's 6'6", which is under – in the height area, But
I've seen him listed as 6'8", though, too. I mean, like we said before, they're all over the place.
But he's either way, he's undersized at his position. He's going to perfect what Draymond Green has done, in my opinion. Draymond Green was the first of his breed, and Zion Williamson's going to be the enhancement of that, okay? Where he's going to be a great defensive guy, in my opinion. He's going to be athletic as heck, because he can jump out the roof. We all know this. If he comes down in transition, just stop running. He's going to make a highlight play. Don't put yourself on a poster. It's not necessary. You have a wife and kid at home. Don't let your kids be subjected to being name called like, dang, your daddy got dunked on last night. Like, don't let them go through that. Just let him score. Okay. Right. So he's going to be that next guy. He's going to be able to shoot three pointers. He's worked very, very hard on shooting those threes here at Duke. And I like that Mike Krzyzewski has made them a note of making sure that his big men know how to shoot. Like, there's a video that surfaced that says everybody on this team will know how to make a standard, like, catch and shoot three.
Yeah.
Because you need to know that in the league, okay? Instead of just allowing him to just be athletically dominant like he was in high school, he's actually taking time to teach everybody the game of basketball, which we don't see very often in college.
Yeah.
So he knows, like, Mike Krzyzewski knows, I got you for a year. Honestly, I can win the tournament with you. I can win the tournament without you. That's not really my point here. But making sure that you're better prepared for the next level of basketball is something that he does very well.
Right, and he's played this team perfectly the way he's done it. You know, you let them go out there and do what they want in the first half, and then if you find yourself down, you say, okay, guys, now you realize that you need to be coached, and then you coach them to a victory, and then they realize, huh, this guy knows what he's talking about. Maybe we should listen to him more. And then you just – it perfects team chemistry, the way he's done it. And, of course, you have to have absurd amounts of talent on your roster to do that. But
and also another thing that he does, he allows the players to choose who's going to shine that night. Mm-hmm. Because, like you said, he allows them the first half, go out, have fun, do what you want to do here.
And I think that's where a lot of
And then he can see which one has the hot hand, and then he allows the players to kind of dictate who's going to get that ball on the last shot.
A lot of the RJ Barrett questions early in the season were about his, you know, shooting efficiency. And I didn't take too much stock in that, because if you watch a Duke basketball game, the first shot or the first half is really just
It's a pickup game.
They're just going after, you know, RJ's like, okay, let me just dribble here. Okay, shoot. And then it's, you know, okay, throw it to Cam. Let him shoot. And then it's Zion, you know, throw a lob to him. See if he can go chase it down and dunk. Get a highlight. The second half is a lot more structured. It's a lot of offensive sets. It's getting to the basket. It's getting open shots. And you see their shooting percentages by half are just ridiculously different. And now you look at RJ when he's having to take over and be the man. When in these last few games they've struggled without Zion. Of course you will when you are missing a player of that caliber. Yeah. But RJ's efficiency has shot up, shooting almost 50% from the field now in the stretch since Zion left.
All right, and I just have one more question for you.
All right,
how do you feel about the whole Trendon Watford situation as it stands right now?
Trendon Watford.
He's our last big recruit remaining.
I'll say I have been following this very closely. I've talked to his coach. I've talked to him once at a tournament before. And I've also indirectly been keeping track of the schools that he's considering. I don't think LSU will get him because of the issues that they're having with Will Wade and the FBI investigation and all of that. I just don't think Trendon wants to walk into that situation right now. Indiana, of course, was on the list pretty much as a favor to the school because his brother went there. You know, you want to keep them happy, thank them for what they did for your brother. And then what it came down to was Alabama and Memphis. Of course, Duke now is bringing him to campus. I thought it was a good sign that he decided to delay his visit to Duke in order to come to the Alabama-Auburn game. I think that kind of sent a message to Duke that, hey, you missed the train. I'll come and I'll hear your pitch, but you weren't calling at my door when Penny Hardaway and Avery Johnson came. And so I put right now, if you asked me to put odds on where he's going, I would say probably 65% to Memphis.
Okay.
I think Wiseman. Wiseman has said multiple times that he calls him every day. Watford acknowledged it, said, yeah, he's on the phone with me all the time. We're always talking about, you know, he wants to play together. He wants to do this. And I think you get them in the gym at the All-American game together, and that's a perfect time for Wiseman to
do
some recruiting. Yes, in the end of March. And so I think Wiseman has done a great job recruiting his friends in Memphis and around the country to come join him, and just the connections to that program that Trendon has. And then I look at the Alabama. I think they're at about 10% chance. I think we hurt ourselves when he was here for the Auburn game. Booing when AJ went in was not a good look. I will not condemn the fans for what they did, because I felt that they were booing the decision, not the player. I think that it came off as booing the player because of the history that the fans have with him, and on social media it's widely known how people feel about him.
I'm sorry, we call spade a spade.
But I do think that in that scenario the boos were on the decision to check in that player who is that far down in your rotation into a game with 10 minutes left that you're trying to hold on to a lead that is starting to dwindle. And so I'm not going to condemn the fans for that. I was okay with that, but it doesn't look good to a recruit who's in the house and skipped a visit to come. And then when Kyra Lewis threw the ball and Auburn intercepted it, the fans were gone, just empty arena before Auburn even shot their free throws. It just cleared out. And that is not a good look to a recruit who is here on a visit. And, you know, maybe, I mean, what if he looks down at his phone for a second after he sees a foul called? He looks up, there's no one left. How does that look? It's just not good when the other teams after him, Duke, the Cameron Crazies aren't leaving for anything. They'll stay late if they were allowed to. They would just live in Cameron Indoor Stadium if you allowed them to. You look at Memphis selling out games. 18,000. That's an NBA arena that they are selling out. And the stands are empty when the buzzer sounds against Auburn, our biggest rival. It was not a good look for Alabama basketball, and I don't think it helped our chances with Trendon Watford, to be completely honest.
Said a lot there.
Yeah.
Said a lot there.
Yeah. It was rough. And again, that was part of the worst part about that Auburn game was, yeah, it sucks to lose to Auburn, and it's terrible to lose in that fashion to anyone, but then to have that scene in front of the recruit that you've wanted for so long, it just wasn't good.
But also, you know, the fans are also chanting his name. Like, I think
two
or three times there in the game as well, like letting us know like his presence is acknowledged here.
Right, it is, and it was that is a good thing, a positive you can take. The picture with Nick Saban, of course, a big positive you can take. I know you were over there, right?
I was over there. I stood.
Trevin working security for that game, standing next to Coach Nick Saban himself.
You can call it security if you want to.
Yeah. What is it? Marketing? So you were
loose security,
right? You were. I mean, you got to stand next to Nick Saban. That's all that really matters.
Yeah. I was in a professional capacity. I could not talk to Nick Saban.
Oh, of course not. But
so it was a very tough 15 minutes of my life for me, knowing that the greatest coach of all time was standing next to me. And I couldn't acknowledge his presence. That was very tough for me. But I managed to pull it off.
Trevin is here to protect and serve.
And also, what they say about him being, what is it, 6'11"?
6'11"?
No, 6'8". 6'8". Yeah. I was looking at the wrong person. What they say about him being 6'8", that's true.
6'8"?
6'8". That's true.
Who are we talking about?
Trenton Walker.
Oh, Trent. Okay.
Yeah. What they say about him.
You were talking about Nick Saban's height before the show, and I did not know where that was going.
So everybody.
I'm sorry.
Everybody says.
Yes, I have talked to Trenton Watford, and yes, he is a legitimate 6'8".
He's a true 6'8". Yes. Like, I didn't realize that until he walked to me, like, past me, and I had to do the head up
thing. Just wait till you see him stand next to James Wiseman, though.
No,
kid is tall.
I saw him standing next to Greg Byrne, and I know Greg Byrne is a good 6'5", 6'4". Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, that's another level. You know, and I –
Right.
That's another level. All right. But, yeah, James Wiseman. Is James Wiseman a true 7-footer?
He's a legit 7-foot. And last I heard, he was still growing. Last I heard.
All right, Anthony Davis, number two. Yeah. But, yeah, so Trenton Walford, number one, I want to say he's a true 6'8". Number two, Nick Saban is not that short, okay? I really want to emphasize
this. All right, we'll go ahead and we're going to fit this in our rank it segment. We're going to rank how impressed you were with height of different people. We've had a lot of issues with conflicting stories on height on this show today.
Yes.
We're a lot of questions out there floating around. How tall is anyone? I think we need a census, and we need to just line people up and mark their height on the doorpost.
Yes.
Who were you more impressed with, Trenton Watford at 6'8" or Nick Saban's height?
I'm dead serious. I'm going to go with Nick Saban, because every time you see a photo of Nick Saban, he has this army of men around him, and he's just charging out head first, and he's got his big army behind him. But then I actually stood next to him. I was like, this guy's not that short. He's like 5'8". Like, he's really not that short. He's just surrounded by big people all the time. I'm a good 5'11", 6 foot. And, like, I looked down a little bit, but, like, not enough to where my head moved, you know? So, like, Nick Saban, he is not that short. I really want to point that out. I don't know if he's grown in the last year or two. He is not that short. He's a cool 5'8", 5'7". Like, man is still, like, you know, he's still, like, he's at average height for a man, in my opinion.
Right,
you know? So I'm going to say Nick Saban.
All right. Let me tell you, for my rank it, since I wasn't down on the floor, unfortunately, I have met Trenton before, and he is very tall. But I have not met Nick Saban, very unfortunately. Sad to be me.
Yes,
but
for you.
But I will say the tallest person I think I've ever met was Mark Gasol. Mark Gasol.
He's 7'2"?
7'1", 7'2", depending on who you hear it from. Again, one of those that you got to see. But he's not only is he so tall, he is big. And when he came in the league, of course, he was overweight. He was, you know, not the big that you want. But
yeah, he was not Paul
in
Gasol.
In his peak, Mark was a buff and still is a buff guy, like just broad shoulders, and just, I mean, standing next to him, I felt like tiny. Just, I understood what it was like to be a normal sized person next to normal tall people.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, of course, I'm 6'2".
There's three people I want to stand next to. And really how big is this person? Number one, LeBron James. I've always wanted to stand next to LeBron James, just like gauge. Like,
I've always wanted to stand next to Steph Curry.
How big is he really?
Because some people say he's tiny. Some people say no, he's a legit 6'4".
Yeah, some people say he's a 6'4". Some people say he's more 6'2". And then some people even stretch and say he's a 6'5". So I really that's a tough one to look at.
Yeah.
To me personally, I think he's a cool 6'3". Just from judging people on the court and looking at them compared to Steph Curry, where they're supposed to be, I think he's either a cool 6'3" or a very slight 6'2" with like a 3/4". Okay, that's just my opinion. I'm not going to say fact on that. But number one is LeBron James. Because people say how big and buff he is. I want to stand next to LeBron James to see just exactly how true that is. Number two, Shaquille O'Neal. Okay, this is a giant.
I mean, he's just big.
I want to be able to just like put his blazer on just to see how big it is. And at number three, he's not an athlete officially, Kevin Hart. I want to see how short.
Kevin Hart?
I want to see how short. He's not officially NASA. He's signed by Nike because I think his height is listed at 5'4", 5'3".
Is it that short? I thought he was listed at like 5'5", 5'6".
Nah, he's like 5'4", 5'3". Like, that's where he's listed at. So I want to see, like, is he really actually that small? Yeah. Or is it just like everyone's around him is just big, you know? Yeah. Like, and then my special guest, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. But anyways.
All right. I can't imagine being like 5'3", because like I said, when I met Mark Gasol.
You got a problem with short people?
No. I'm just saying, like, growing up, like, I was taller than all my friends, at least, except for my basketball. People on the basketball team.
Must be nice.
I was a guard on the basketball team.
Must be nice.
And so when I got to high school, my friends were like, hey, you're tall. And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm a guard. What are you talking about? I'm not tall. And then, you know, they're like, no, you're tall. So when I met Mark Gasol, it was like, wow, this guy is huge. And so I'm like, what if I was Kevin Hart's size? And Kevin Hart hangs out at NBA games. Like, Kevin Hart and Joel Embiid, like, hanging out. Like, that's got to be, like, weird. Like, you're looking up at somebody 2 feet above you, right?
Yeah.
And that's how we'll close this
maybe
edition.
Maybe we'll find out one day.
Of the No Noise Podcast. Thanks again, guys. No, we went all over the sport of basketball today. Hope you guys enjoyed the podcast. Tune in next week. Or do not tune in next week. We will not be here. It is spring break at the University of Alabama. I will be out of the country. And
must be nice.
We will be doing, I believe, a special selection show Sunday. We will be live streaming for you guys on Twitter. You can look at that at No Noise Podcast, and you will be able to see what we think about the field as it shapes up. Hope to see you guys then. And as always, Roll Tide.
Roll Tide.